Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. In 2019, a story with a very unusual protagonist was submitted to us. Although the role of court interpreter seems intuitively a good fit for a crime story, I did not recall ever before having received a submission with such a character in the starring role. The author of the tale, Jeff Soloway, was the 2014 winner of the Robert L. Fish Award for Best Short Story by a New American Author. In the years since that auspicious beginning, he's gone on to contribute short stories to a number of different publications and to write a series of novels featuring a travel writer's sleuth. Here is Jeff Soloway reading his story, The Interpreter and the Killer, from the January-February 2021 issue of EQMM.
I met Antonio, the trial's star witness, in the proffer room of the Brooklyn courthouse. The prosecutor had prepared me beforehand. Before his arrest, Antonio had resorted to plastic surgery to try to disguise his identity, and apparently the cartel had trouble retaining the best medical talent. His face was now just wrong, the chin and cheekbones unnaturally heavy, the nose and brows jutting off kilter. It was like a child's drawing of a face, detailed, but completely inaccurate. I'm a licensed federal Spanish interpreter, and my skills are mostly needed on international drug trafficking cases, like this one, though this one dwarfed them all. You could fill a soccer stadium with all the snitching drug mules, bagmen, message boys, and enforcers I've interpreted for. You probably think they're the scum of the earth. Not me. I feel for them. It's my job. I waved at Antonio, knowing he was prohibited from shaking my hand. Sonia, the federal prosecutor who had hired me, asked him to give me a preview of his testimony. Like all prosecutors, Sonia believes in making both the witness and the interpreter practice beforehand. She wants the testimony delivered just so, and she never forgets that what the jury hears actually comes from the interpreter, not the witness, whom they can't understand. Antonio shook his head. Sonia leaned over the desk, flirty and menacing at the same time. She's half Argentinian and speaks excellent Spanish. Antonio, sweetheart, made a deal. Ask your lawyer. Antonio's lawyer leaned back against the wall and shrugged. The DEA guy just stared. He spoke only English. Antonio stared down at hands that were scarred and swollen from incidents I could only imagine. I told the last interpreter. According to Sonia, the last interpreter had suddenly quit just after hearing Antonio's story. In desperation, Sonia offered me 3 times my normal fee to take over. My father, over the phone, had advised against it. "This trial is in the Times," he announced. "Keep away from it. The courthouse is located in Brooklyn. Do you live near Brooklyn? Avoid the entire borough. El Guiso is the evilest murderer in South American history, and I include Pizarro." I was afraid of agitating his heart, so I assured him that I would avoid both the trial and the borough. But I took the job anyway. I needed the money, and he was the reason why. "Remember, Antonio," Sonia was saying, "I'm the only friend you have." She leaned back and grinned, as if she had already won the argument, but I saw a flash of panic in her bleary eyes. She probably hadn't slept since the trial had started. From reading the newspaper reports, I knew it was going poorly. Months before, 2 potential witnesses had been murdered in different lockups, one in Colombia and one in the United States. Several more had declined to cooperate. "Antonio," I said, "tell me, only me. Those 2 tight asses can go have a meeting with their phones, right?" Antonio's attorney gritted his teeth, but nodded. He had negotiated Antonio's deal. Antonio squinted at me across the room. He'd been in protective custody for more than a year. Staring every day at nothing but the blank wall 5 feet away ruins a lot of prisoners' eyesight. "No," he said. I'd seen this before. Antonio was embarrassed, not just by his crimes, but by the disgust they provoked. I thought I could ease his self-consciousness. I sat down, lay my hand on the table, and brought it as close to his as I dared. The DEA guy stared. Both lawyers turned away and backed off. They knew how I worked. Every decent interpreter has a nimble mind and effortless fluency in 2 languages. But what the best possess is empathy. An interpreter without a deep and intuitive understanding of her subject, without a sense of who her subject is and how he speaks and thinks, is like a driver navigating unfamiliar roads. She can't operate at speed. She can't anticipate speech patterns, word choices, verbal stumbles. She can't do her job. My favorite person to interpret for is my father. When he was able, my father used to visit once a year, and I loved bringing him around to my friends, especially my monolingual American friends. My father is vain of his language, and though he speaks English decently, he regards himself as a master of Spanish. I do too. Because I know him so well, I can mimic his speech patterns, including his cutting asides, dramatic pauses, and hammy emphases. I can capture his dry wit, his offhand insights, his entire personality. I'll never feel as close with anyone else, so I'll never interpret as well. But the more closely I can identify with a witness, the better I'll do. It's not always easy. I've done 100 trials, I told Antonio. You can't scare me. You're about as old as my father.
Don't tell me your father looks like me, he said. Nobody looks like me.
I could see that admitting this was harder than he pretended. No one likes to be stared at, even in prison, where the inmates are still as petty and as cruel as children, if much stronger. Yes, Antonio was a bit like my father. They both possessed a kind of vanity that they disguised as gruffness. Your eyes look the same, I said. I stared straight into them. Antonio's eyes may have been slow to focus, but they were at least undamaged by surgery or violence. He began his story. When I interpret in court, I submerge my own identity as I repeat the witness's words. As much as possible, I become the witness in my mind. Here's what Antonio told me, and what I restated in my own mind, in English.
We found the two men far from their homes, along with a wife. They had been double-dealing with El Guiso's men, and pocketing the extra fees. I beat the men with my fists for some time. Then we tossed all three in the car and drove them to the fields outside the city. We tied the men to chairs, just beside a blazing bonfire. El Guiso arrived and began to question them. At first they denied everything. El Guiso became very angry and ordered me to punish them. I picked up a branch from near the fire and used it to beat their arms, legs, ribs, and more. I believe I broke every bone in their body except their skulls. The wife screamed until El Guiso told her to shut up or she'd suffer the same way.
Antonio's cartoonish face remained impassive, but he had to pause to gather strength to continue. It struck me that his details were almost poetic. I could imagine the wife falling suddenly silent, her screaming replaced with smaller but equally terrifying sounds, the fire crackling and the men's groaning. To describe his instrument of punishment, he had used the word tronco, which means trunk or big branch, but I decided that I should translate it as club. Better to express a thing's purpose rather than its origin.
When I finished, the men sat there limp. They were unable to move. They moaned only a little. They were afraid of angering us further. I untied them. They slumped off the chairs. El Guiso wanted more information. From the ground they tried to speak, but we could hardly understand them. El Guiso ordered me to burn them. Their eyes opened wide. They tried to speak. I dragged them toward the fire. El Guiso told me to continue. I threw them both in the flames, where they died.
This was the man I had to empathize with. This was the beast I would have to become on the stand. To hide my revulsion, which would have destroyed his trust in me, I let my face narrow into a kind of sorrowful pout and tried to pour fake sympathy into my eyes. How terrible to see, I murmured, hoping I would never see the incident in my dreams.
You understand me.
To my surprise, tears were dripping into the exaggerated hollows in Antonio's face. He sat up straighter in his chair. I thought of his limp victims.
But when El Guiso ordered me to beat the wife too, I said, enough! What do wives have to do with our business? El Guiso laughed at me. I have a soft spot for women. Everyone knows it.
Nothing was more horrifying to me than this murderer's pride at his own weakness.
I wasn't always so ugly, he added.
Section 2. The next morning, I emailed my father from my local Starbucks. Ever since the hurricane, which came not long after his heart attack, I've been trying to persuade him to leave Puerto Rico. He lives outside of Ponce, on the south coast. The local hospital suffers regular blackouts and shortages of basic supplies like IV bags and rubber gloves. Half his doctor's appointments are canceled at the last minute, since the doctors themselves are escaping the island. I want him to come live with me, but I can barely afford rent in my studio, let alone a place with room for him. That's why I needed the fee from the trial. A young man stood over my table. Buenos dias, he said in a gringo accent, and then in English, haven't I seen you at the courthouse? He raised his eyebrows devilishly, as if his approach was a sophisticated joke that he fully expected me to understand. The fringes of his floppy hair tickled the tops of his eyebrows. I guessed he was one of the cadre of junior courthouse reporters, an ambitious, imploring species for whom I have some pity, but little time. He sat down without asking. I want you to pass on a message. His knee hopped around under the table like a fish trying to flop out of a boat. Maybe not a reporter then. As I often do, I became that man, stuck with an urgent and so far undelivered message. Anxious, and not just because he was chatting up a woman at Starbucks. His brother was in jail, and he hoped I could help. Or maybe he was angling for a job, as if any New Yorker who had conquered high school Spanish could become a licensed federal interpreter in a week. To who? I asked. To the man you're working with. You know, the witness. His placid face was now trembling, and I knew why he was afraid. He was obviously no cartel thug, just a freelance errand boy, but with an extremely scary boss. Who sent you? Don't worry, he was whispering now. No one's upset with you. They want to offer you a job for good money. Get away from me, I was whispering too. Wait, you'll be paid just for hearing me out. And if you pass on the message, and if he listens, I mean really listens, then you'll get more, way more. I said, you want me to tell him he'll be killed if he snitches. He already knows you want to do that. Everyone does. I say he deserves it. He's a monster. You all are. Me? He said. I'm just doing a job. I'm just somebody's cousin in Queens. It's not a threat anyway. Here's the message. We know where Laura lives. That's it. Pass this on. And if he takes the hint, well, you'll make a lot more than you make at the courthouse. He shook his head and muttered, a monster. Who's Laura? His wife? His mom? How would I know? Listen, Elguizo's a bad dude, but this witness, he's a freak. I've heard what he did. I don't know how he could work with him. I'm calling the cops. I reached for my phone. He leaped up and hustled out of the store. I let the phone go. What would I say? That night, someone rang my doorbell, and when I answered, I found a plain brown package outside my door. No stamp, no address, no messenger. The package turned out to hold $10,000 in $100 bills, enough to fly my father over, enough to pay moving costs, first month's rent, and a security deposit on a new apartment. Section 3. The next day, I told Sonia we needed to talk. She immediately shut the door to her office, sat me in a chair, and refused to let me speak. She laid a hand on each of my shoulders and stared deeply but blindly into my eyes. Tell me! She said, meaning, tell me your problems so I can vaporize them with my voice. As a rule, prosecutors are devoid of empathy. They are, however, excellent practical psychologists, and particularly adept at cajoling, badgering, and, when necessary, threatening. She said, our last interpreter almost puked after Antonio told his story. I know he's a sicko, but he's the only witness left who can tie Elguizo directly to murder. We need you almost as bad as we need him. Any further delay just gives Elguizo's lawyers another chance to object, and his thugs more time to get to Antonio. Isn't he in protective custody? I asked. Anything can happen in prison. But accidents were even easier to organize outside prison. Does Antonio have family? I asked. Have you looked at him? Guys like that don't have wives and kiddos. We've checked thoroughly. No one visits, no one writes. If Elguizo wanted to get to him, he'll have to get to him. His goons have already plugged two witnesses in custody, one in Colombia, one here, and like five more before we could arrest them. I want you to think of that. Think of how often the cartel has killed people we aren't protecting. Think of how many more they'll kill in the years to come. This is maybe our last chance to put Elguizo away. What could I say to that? She added, he likes you. Don't you always say that makes your job easier? How can you tell? His lawyer. He's a gossip. He told him you're the only one on the team he trusts. Even the prison guards have heard of you. Apparently, they laughed at him after he ordered a book on Puerto Rico from the prison library. All they had was a 2003 travel guide to San Juan. Prison libraries cracked me up. Sonia led me to the proffer room. We proceeded to practice her directs in English and Antonio's answers in Spanish, along with my interpretation of both, to accustom him to the rhythm of court. Her phone kept interrupting her. Finally, she announced she had to leave for a staff meeting. I wondered if her staff was presenting her with yet another unpleasant surprise. "You two talk amongst yourselves till I get back," she said, "but not about the case. Remember, conversation is preparation." Antonio nodded, eager to please.
"What can we talk about? Our hometowns?"
After all, he was now an expert on San Juan, which is not even where I'm from. Sonia knew that was a bad idea. "Tell her what you liked to do as a kid." Great. He probably battered stray cats with a fence post, then dragged them home to roast them alive. Sonia dashed off. Antonio's lawyer had never showed that day. He had better paying clients to deal with. Only the armed, and monolingual, DEA agent remained.
"My mother worked for a wealthy family in the city."
Antonio paused unconsciously, as if to let me interpret, then chuckled at himself. And for a moment, as crinkles disguised the slopes and hollows of his face, he looked almost normal.
"I lived with my grandmother, who washed clothing. She was always tired and never spoke to me. My mother would return to our home every Saturday evening and leave again late on Sunday. On Saturday, I would sit in a wall near the bus stop and wait for her. There were four of us in the neighborhood who would wait for our mothers. We would push each other off the wall to get the best spot, or fight for the best spot. Adults would yell at us, but we were all fighting for our mothers. I was the strongest and the best fighter."
"Did you ever hurt any of them?" I asked.
"Probably. They hurt me. They hated me, because I was the dirtiest and the poorest. So they fought together. One day, one of them pulled me down off the wall by the knees, and the other two jumped down on my stomach. They kicked me in the ribs and the face. But I pushed them off and smashed the nose of the nearest boy. Blood exploded out of his nostrils. They were all afraid. They were only kids. And they ran away. I climbed up on the wall again. I was careful to wipe my face with the back of my arm, not my shirt, because my grandmother would discover the stain. An older boy was watching. He said I had courage for a kid. He said I could do some jobs for him, take messages to his friends. It wasn't an offer. It was a command. But I was glad to accept it. I was 11 years old. When my mother arrived, I told her I was a man. And so I began my career."
He raised one eyebrow humorously, ruefully. Or maybe he was raising both eyebrows. It was hard to tell on that face. Instead of translating, I had simply been imagining the story. But in my mind, I was the protagonist, not him. And the other children were girls. And the city was Ponce. And the bus stop was outside my house. When I was a girl, I always had my father at home. And I was never so poor as to be dirty. But neither was I rich enough to escape being shamed by other children, or noble enough not to shame in return. I, too, had laughed and taunted and even scuffled. We girls in the neighborhood never fought till we bled, but our insults were violent enough in my memory. "How much money did that older boy give you for the jobs?" I asked.
"Enough to help my mother and grandmother, just a little at first, then more and more."
Was one of those women alive, unbeknownst to Sonia? I tried to think of the broken bones and burning bodies, but it was too late. Antonio the torturer was now to me also a survivor of humiliation and violence, an innocent, proud of helping out, both long ago in his Colombian hometown and right now in Brooklyn. "What was your mother's first name?" I asked.
"Gabriela," he said.
"And your grandmother?"
"Cecilia. I like the way you look at me. I told Sonia I was afraid to tell my horror story in court. She said to stare in your eyes when I felt nervous. I wish I could be telling it to you, just you. My lawyer tells me that it is not allowed."
His face seemed to collapse into itself, the nose flopping sideways, like a little door opening, and I realized his attempt at a self-deprecatory grin was really an expression of deepest gratitude. I said, "I received a message yesterday from a strange man, a message for you."
"You mean from El Guiso?"
His face filled up again with anger. "I think so."
"A threat?"
he said. "Of course."
"Son of a bitch. He forced me to testify. Why did he go to trial? He should have pleaded guilty and accepted prison, like all the rest of us. What did he say?"
I spoke the message, translated to Spanish, of course. "We know where Laura lives." "What does it mean? Who is Laura?" Antonio fell silent. The DEA man, alerted by the soaring tone of my voice, raised his eye from his phone.
"It's no one," Antonio said at last. "Tell Sonia I'm finished talking. I will not testify. Where is my lawyer?
He lifted his face and called to the DEA agent, one of the few English phrases he knew.
I want to go now.
Later that day, as Sonia and I left the courthouse together, she made light of his nerves. We just have to remind him that this is Brooklyn, not Cali. He'll be fine. I knew she was mainly trying to reassure herself. He's afraid for someone, I said.
Sure, himself. All brutes like him are cowards. But this is his only way out of life in prison. He'll still get 20 years in a supermax. After tomorrow, I hope I never see his ugly face again.
As I left the courthouse, I thought of the money in my freezer. By passing on the message, I had now earned it. Maybe more was on the way. I was one of El Guiso's employees, too. Who was Laura? I thought about the man's warning, how it sounded, both in English and in Spanish. And then suddenly I knew Antonio's secret. The first thing I did was dig the $10,000 package out of the freezer.
Section 4. Antonio was the final witness. The first time I saw him that day was as he was taking the stand, and I was taking my seat beside him. I was told that prior witnesses had slapped their hearts and pointed to El Guiso before the swearing-in to attest to their continuing loyalty and proclaim publicly that their testimony was coerced. Antonio gave El Guiso no gesture and no look. El Guiso, however, stared contemptuously at him, as if to remind Antonio that he was less than an insect, that nothing he did would ever matter to anyone, except his death, which would give El Guiso some small pleasure. At one point, El Guiso's eyes fixed on me, and I quickly looked away. Everyone else in the courtroom was staring at Antonio's distorted face. Because of my position beside him, it felt like they were staring at me. Antonio further drew attention by acknowledging me with a relieved nod that I was professionally required to ignore. He wiped his forehead with his sleeve. Sonia began her direct. Antonio handled the preliminary questions easily. He introduced himself, described his role in the cartel, and cataloged the crimes for which he had pleaded guilty. I rendered every word without hesitation or glitch. His confidence was easy to mirror, his language straightforward and simple. His determination to testify was unaltered. I had not, after all, undermined justice or changed history by passing on the message. And then Sonia cited the date of Antonio's horrific story. "Tell us what happened," she said, "in your own words." Now Antonio slowed down and paused more frequently, as Sonia had coached him. The poetic touches, the wife screaming, the fires crackling, were gone. He wiped his forehead again, but this time, he stared at his sleeve afterward, as if it might be stained with blood. I stuttered a few times and fumbled once when he used an unfamiliar word, but the end of our ordeal was near.
"I picked up the club," Antonio said in Spanish, using the word tronco that I had prepared for, a word that would forever signify to me not just a branch or a trunk or a club, but a brutal beating. "I picked up the club," I said in English. "I beat them until they could no longer move."
"I beat them until they could no longer move." In courtrooms, there's always some hum of activity. The clicking of the court reporter's keys, the audience's shifting and breathing, the pattering of reporters taking electronic notes. But at this point, Antonio paused, and the entire room went silent. A few spectators craned their heads or leaned forward to get a better view of him, giving me a better view of their faces. Outrage and disgust filled every one of them. And I knew those emotions would only burn higher as the story swept on to its gruesome end. If they knew the truth, that I too had taken money from El Guiso, they would have hated me as well. Perhaps they did already, at least subconsciously. After all, it was my voice they were shuddering at. Sonia had to prompt her witness. And then what happened?
We all knew what had happened.
Sonia and I knew it from hearing the tale. El Guiso and Antonio from first-hand experience. Everyone else in the courtroom, from El Guiso's reputation and from Antonio's place in the trial. Here was the incriminating testimony. Here was the killing ordered by El Guiso himself.
Antonio's head drooped on his shoulders. At first, I thought the effort of speaking into the face of universal condemnation had finally overcome him. But then his eyes slid toward mine, fixed on my face beside him, and I knew why he had stopped.
An interpreter never speaks on her own. But I gave him a quick nod, not nearly as gentlemanly as his own, to convince him to carry on. If only I could speak to him, but that was forbidden. He lifted his face.
"I?"
he said. One word, not enough to interpret. I waited for more. We all did.
"I don't..."
Again he stopped. His eyes were unfocused. I knew what he was going to say.
"I don't remember."
But he had to say it before I could. He took a deep breath. Antonio's lawyer was clasping his hand so hard the knuckles were turning white. He was watching the collapse of his plea deal. Antonio would spend his life in prison. El Guiso would go free. El Guiso squinted, as if to see his moment of triumph as sharply as possible. And then I did something I never do in court. I coughed. The sound, small but imposing, a tiny tear in the fabric of ceremony, echoed through the courtroom. Antonio, startled, glanced at me. I saw, reflected in his eyes, the horror all around him, the growing fury in Sonia's face, the triumph of El Guiso. I tried to replace their gazes with my calm one. I tried to make my face a safe harbor for him. He shook his head one time, only for me. He opened his mouth. No sound came out. Only I knew what he was mouthing. La Laura. I already understood. I coughed again, several times, much louder, and placed my hand over the microphone as I winced an apology at the judge. Then I turned aside and whispered in Spanish, so that only Antonio could hear me. I left my apartment. Antonio lifted an eyebrow. I coughed again, and then murmured, "I'm safe. I leave New York tonight." The warning, as Antonio had understood from the start, had been meant for me. Antonio smiled. I think he was looking directly at El Guiso. I freed the microphone from my hand and signaled my readiness to the judge and to Sonia. She repeated the question. "What happened next?" Antonio replied, "El Guiso ordered me to kill them." "El Guiso ordered me to kill them," I said.
"So I threw them both in the fire. We watched them burn until they died."
I repeated his words.
Section 5. At the break, I went to wash my face in the ladies' room, but my hands shook too hard for me to turn the faucet.
"Maria!"
I turned. It was Sonia.
"Thank you," she said.
I wanted to jab my pen in his crooked eye, but whatever you did worked.
She embraced me. She never asked me to explain. She preferred not to know. El Guiso returned to his high-security jail in Manhattan to wait for sentencing. Antonio returned to his prison for the rest of his long term inside. That night, I returned to my hotel in Brooklyn and booked a flight the next day to Puerto Rico. I used El Guiso's cash, both for the room and for the airfare. The next day I read online that my apartment building had suffered a mysterious and suspicious fire. El Loro means parrot in Spanish, and La Laura is a female parrot, a term that captures my job as an interpreter in an appropriately, for El Guiso, belittling manner. Unlike me, who had heard the warning first in English, Antonio heard it in Spanish and understood it right away. El Guiso's men knew where I lived. They had also discovered, perhaps from a prison source, perhaps from someone close to Antonio's lawyer, that I was someone he cared for, perhaps even someone he would risk his plea deal to protect. And they were right. But by abandoning my apartment and assuring Antonio of my safety, I had thwarted their plan. I carried the rest of the money in my suitcase to San Juan and then to Ponce. Cartel money is what my father and I will live on for the next few months. In mingling words and thoughts with Antonio, I seem to have taken on some of his personal qualities, his corruption, which I proved by accepting the money, and his courage, which I believe I proved in the courtroom. Or maybe I simply recognized and developed what was inside me all along, as the murderer Antonio recognized his own capacity for sacrifice. And now we both see ourselves for who we really are and who we could have been. But only one of us escaped punishment.
The Interpreter and the Killer is copyrighted by Jeff Soloway. The music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Ray Purdom and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.